So turn with me this morning to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis chapter 39. Following a brief interruption or intermission or interlude in the previous chapter, we resume our study of the life and times of Joseph. When we last talked about Joseph in chapter 37, you'll recall that he was sold to a caravan of Midianite traders who then took him to Egypt and sold him to Potiphar, Pharaoh's captain of the guard. We pick up now at verse 1 of chapter 39. Read it with me. Verse 1, chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. If you're not aware of this, the name Potiphar actually means the one whom the sun god Ra has given. As impressive as that name might appear, it's important to understand that, as is true in nearly every society, babies back then were named not just in accordance with any position they might have enjoyed at the time of their birth. They were named very often with a view to what they might become. It was an expression of mom and dad's hopes and their dreams. So it really doesn't indicate anything as far as Potiphar inheriting a position. It doesn't mean anything about his being important from the day of his birth. He was named the one whom the sun god Ra has given, no doubt out of appreciation to the false god Ra by his parents, and also, again, out of the hope that he might become something prominent one day. And he did rise to relative prominence. It's not a common thing to, especially in Egypt, if you know anything about their society, if you know anything about their social structure, it's not easy to rise to any sort of position within Pharaoh's court. And yet Potiphar had done that. He is the captain of the guard, or captain of the bodyguard. Now, what's interesting about the name Potiphar is that it could mean something else. And in fact, I think it actually does mean something else. Scholars are divided on what the name actually means as far as his position was concerned. Many scholars believe that Potiphar was also, or was probably, not just the captain of the guard. This title could also be rendered chief of the cooks, which would actually make Potiphar a butler. So Potiphar might have very well been Pharaoh's butler. Now, don't think Downton Abbey and the whole, you know, scene going on there. They weren't nearly as refined. They weren't nearly as structured as 19th, 20th century, early 20th century England. But Pharaohs had butlers. They had men who would go and do their bidding as far as all the household chores were concerned. They had men who would make sure that all the meals were cooked and cooked to exact specifications and so on and so forth. There's even more, though, surrounding Potiphar's name that we need to make careful note of. The name Potiphar is actually identical with the name Potiphera. If you look over at Genesis 41:45, you'll see the name Potiphera. And who was Potiphera? Well, if he was the same as Potiphar, this adds another job title. Potiphera was a priest of On. The priests of On were those who conducted and oversaw the Egyptians' worship of Ra, the sun god. The priests of On were also considered to be the most intelligent, most cultured individuals in all of Egypt. And as we'll see when we get to chapter 41, Joseph will later marry Potiphera's daughter, Asenath. But here's the $64,000 question. Are they actually the same person? Well, most scholars and even some reputable Egyptologists believe that the answer is yes. They're the same person. So why the different names? Well, back then, as I said, names not only signified the hopes and dreams and aspirations of the parents, names also had other meanings. When you placed slight inflections on the names, slight differences in spelling and so on and so forth, you could actually change one's name in terms of their function, their duties, and so on and so forth. Most scholars have concluded that the name Potiphar was used to denote the way this individual fattened the bulls for the purpose of idol worship, which incidentally that would make the chief of the cook's title more likely. One of his responsibilities was making sure that all the animals used in their idolatrous practices were sufficiently fattened. After all, I mean, the sacrificial system that was set up to appease the sun god Ra served two purposes. Number one, you could sacrifice an animal to him, and it had to be an animal that was very fit, very healthy. But number two, there was something in it for them as well. If you're going to sacrifice an animal, you might as well find the best one that's suitable for eating. And so you'd want him to be fat. You know, they would cloak this under the guise of being a more fit sacrifice for Ra. No, it's just tastier. And so the chief of the cooks would take it upon himself to make sure that the animals were fat so that they would have enough to feed everyone following these idolatrous worship services. Now, when performing his priestly duties, which again makes perfect sense, if he was the one responsible for fattening up the animals, he could very easily be seen as the one who was doing the sacrifices of these animals, right? So when he's called Potipharah, this refers to his practice of ritually uncovering himself during worship. I'm not going to go into that. Let's just suffice it to say the Egyptians were very big on debauchery. The Egyptians were not these clean-cut, this is not Yul Brynner in the Ten Commandments and his stately court. And, you know, the Egyptians were very idolatrous and very sensual, if you get my meaning there. The religion that they practiced was steeped in debauchery because they believed that their God liked that sort of thing. I mean, after all, they enjoyed that sort of thing, so why wouldn't their god Ra like that sort of thing as well? Many reputable scholars believe that Potiphar purchased Joseph for the sole purpose of abusing him sexually as part of their ritual. And this has, again, been borne out by many in the realm of Egyptology. This is what they did. When you bought a slave, you didn't buy a slave just to be a hired hand. You didn't buy a slave just to increase your workforce. In many, many cases, you bought slaves for this sort of thing. As horrible as that sounds. I could say more, but I won't. So let me just ask you, did Potiphar succeed in this area? In other words, he bought Joseph as a slave. He wants to use him for these nefarious purposes. Did he succeed at that? No. Why not? Keep reading at verse 2. Moses writes, "The Lord was with Joseph." That's why not. There's your answer. As God's chosen instrument, as one who would play such a pivotal role, not just in the temporal salvation of his own family during the famine, but he would also play a significant role in God's overall redemptive plan. And God ensured, on the basis of his plans for Joseph, that wherever Joseph went, he would be protected. And not only was he protected, but he prospered. Let me ask you this. Was Joseph's prosperity immediate? No. No. Remember, he was purchased by Potiphar to be a slave. And it was only after proving himself and earning Potiphar's trust that he was actually promoted and given more responsibility. This is important. Why? Well, it's important because we need to understand that very often prosperity comes at a cost. Prosperity takes time. You youngins out there need to understand that you cannot expect to have what took your mom and dad the better part of 18, 20 years. You can't expect to have that the moment you step out of their house. The moment you begin making your own way in this world, you need to expect that it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And if you keep your nose to the grindstone, you will get there. But you have no reason to expect. And I know, you know, this runs contrary to what the government wants you to believe. The government that we live under today wants you to believe that you can and you should have all these things. That you're entitled to these things. That the world owes you these things. Let me give you a list of the things that the world owes you. I'm done. The world does not owe you anything. Right? Understand that. You're not entitled to anything. Even if you play peewee sports, there are winners and losers. You know, if you're in a position where you lose, lick your wounds, practice harder, and do better. Oh, but I got a snow cone. I got a trophy. We're all winners. No, you're not. Life is full of winners and losers, and sometimes you're going to be losers. Joseph was certainly a loser in every imaginable way. Joseph can't even get along in his own family. His brothers want to kill him initially, and they settle for selling him. They sell him. When he gets to Potiphar, it's not an easy thing. It's a hard thing. And yet he does it regardless because he knows that the Lord is sustaining him. He knows that God will be faithful to him. And so he goes and he does. How many of you married people, if you've been married for any length of time, how many of you remember what it's like to be poor? Dan and I tell these frightening stories about when we were first married. I was active duty. She wasn't working. We were having kids. And you know, we would take a calculator to the commissary to buy groceries. And every 2 weeks, we'd spend $50 every 2 weeks. And we fed our family on $50 every 2 weeks. Once a month, we would eat out. Right? Contrast and compare that to today, though. And that's not been that long ago. It's been, well, 38 years ago. Children, that's not a long time ago, okay? But life was hard for us. And think back to your grandparents and your great-grandparents. And, you know, we've lost that sort of understanding of struggle. And the struggle is real, or it should be, and the struggle is really beneficial if you understand who your God is and how He does provide, even in those meager days. But Joseph was eventually promoted. Again, hard work, proving himself. He was promoted and given more responsibility. Moses explains that in what follows. Keep reading. So he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer of his house. And all that he owned, he put in his charge. It came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and all that he had owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. In the process of protecting Joseph from, again, from Potiphar's nefarious intent, God allowed Joseph to prove his worth. He allowed the situation to develop to the extent that Potiphar no longer saw him as an object of abuse. He no longer saw him as a plaything, as it were, but he began to see his real value. I don't know how long it took, but I'm sure Potiphar at some point realized, this is not just an ordinary slave that I'm dealing with here. He's intelligent. He's well kept. He's very devoted to his God. He's very trustworthy. And so Potiphar said, you know, in light of all those things, I'm going to promote him. And he did. And he gave him charge over everything in his house. God not only sustained Joseph, but he actually promoted him to one of the most desirable positions in Egypt. A position that, understand, this is a position that most natural-born Egyptian men could only dream of. And here it is happening to a slave. Can God not do the same for you and me? Can God not do the same for us? He can, and in many cases, He has. Right? James, do you have something? Absolutely. That's enough, right? That should be enough, right? Yeah, He's redeemed us. And that should be enough. But in addition to redeeming every one of us in this room, He has either prospered us or He's in the process of prospering us. I mean, you might be sitting there thinking, well, my ship hasn't come in yet. Well, it will. If it's part of God's plan that it does. You know, it might be God's plan for you to be poor. I know the, you know, health and wealth gospel hucksters out there hate it when pastors say that. But it might be that God wants you to stay poor and dependent until such time as He does prosper you. And how long does that take? I don't know. We don't know. Yes.
God's providence.
No, because there's nothing independent of God's providence. Yes. Yes. Oh, true. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we don't take the Eeyore attitude. Well, I guess this is as good as it gets. So I'm just going to, you know, I'm not going to do anything to improve myself. No. Get out there and improve yourself. You know? Yes. Right. But at the end of the day, Joseph was who he was by the grace of God. Every step of the way. Whether he was pre-slave Joseph or post-slave Joseph, prosperous or poor, he was who he was by the grace of God. Verse 6b. And this doesn't hurt. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Especially today. You know, I think handsome people get a break that ugly people don't. Hey, it's a fact of life. It's a fact of life. But should that matter? No, it shouldn't matter. I mean, Bill Gates is nothing to look at. Right? Elon Musk? Anybody? So, I mean, that's not a sure thing. But in the vapid, shallow society in which we live, looks are fairly important. Now, why does Moses make mention here of Joseph's looks? Because Potiphar's wife was actually a shallow woman. Right? Read on. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There's no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? We can see here a little more how the sensual religion of the Egyptians actually influenced their overall conduct. Potiphar's wife really had no problem approaching Joseph in this way. Why? Because by and large their whole existence was predicated on the idea that they were sexually free, that they could just do whatever. Much like society today. Anything goes, at least in her mind. Potiphar's wife saw nothing wrong with attempting to seduce Joseph because her religion didn't prohibit that sort of thing. In fact, in a lot of ways, her religion actually instigated that sort of thinking, promoted that sort of behavior. Joseph, on the other hand, as a believer in the one true God, didn't share her worldview. So when she approached him, Joseph's refusal was actually predicated on two very important godly principles. First, he knew that it would be wrong of him to betray the trust that had been placed in him by Potiphar. And this is one of the things we can all learn. If you're hired by a person to do a job, you're to do that job as unto the Lord. You're to do that job without complaint. You're to do that job to the best of your ability, according to God's gifting you with various talents. You're to do that job with as much gusto as you can muster. Joseph understood this. And so he knew that he shouldn't do anything that might betray the trust that Potiphar had placed in him. But secondly, and more importantly, Joseph knew that to fall to the seduction of Potiphar's wife would constitute a great sin against God. I've pointed this out many times in the past, but it certainly bears repeating this morning. We would all do well to see our sins not as an affront to one another, but for what they really are, an affront to God. You know, we spend way too much time looking at things on this plane, on the horizontal. We're so worried about what other people think about us. We're so worried about hurting others' feelings. We're so worried about sinning against each other and other people sinning against us. But the moment we begin to look on this plane and realize that the sins we commit are not necessarily, at least not first and foremost, sins against one another, they're sins against God Himself. Then we will start to grow. Right? As David admitted to the Lord in Psalm 51:4, we should also pray, against you and you only, I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Do you pray that way? Do you think that way? Most of the time we don't. Most of the time, let me just ask you a fairly penetrating question here. Most of the time when you sin against someone, is your first instinct to apologize to them or seek forgiveness from God? That'll tell you where your heart's at. Before you ever go apologize to anyone, make it right with God. Confess your sin to Him. Repent of that sin. And then move on. And part of your moving on is to apologize. And make it right with one another. Well, did Potiphar's wife take no for an answer? Not at all. Verse 10. As she spoke to Joseph day after day, what? I mean, this is a woman who's not going to give up, right? I mean, think about it. Joseph can't go anywhere. He's captive in the home. He's been given certain responsibilities in and around the house. He's responsible for everything Potiphar has, except his wife. He will not take on that responsibility because he knows it's wrong. But she's speaking to him day after day. And as she spoke to him, he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. Okay, men, lesson. Don't ever, 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 ever find yourself with a woman who's not your wife, where there are no other men around. You understand that? Don't do it. Don't do it. Even when I'm counseling, you know, Steve's really good about this. Most of my counseling on Wednesday afternoons, even when I'm counseling young women, older women, women in my office, Steve or John or both of them will be right out in that little room outside. And they do that to protect me. They do that to make sure that no accusations could come my way later about impropriety. Right? And I really appreciate that sort of thing. You know, I like that sort of thing for my wife as well, because it gives her the confidence to know that I'm not subjecting myself to those sorts of things. I mean, we could speak volumes about this. Men, you need to understand this. What should Joseph have done when he realized there were no other men in the household? Go do something outside. Or if you have to do things inside, go find a man and bring him in. So you're going to be my buddy today. Right? That didn't happen. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And it's in the emphatic. She's not asking now. She's demanding. And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. Should have gone outside to begin with. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came into me to make sport of me. And as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." See what can happen? Here we see the original spokeswoman for the Me Too movement. It's true. Now listen, I am as concerned and as compassionate as anyone you'll ever meet when it comes to sin against women, when it comes to men abusing women. In my generation, when that sort of thing happens, the severest penalty should follow. Men, we don't abuse women. Verbally, physically, mentally, we do not abuse women. We understand that, but some women don't. Verifiable assault is one thing. It's another thing altogether for a woman to use false claims of assault, either as a means of personal gain, or as a means of deflecting their own share of the blame onto the man. Right? Would you agree with that? Things like what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, Supreme Court Justice, during his confirmation hearings. The Duke lacrosse players who were wrongfully accused of the same type of thing and had their reputations permanently destroyed. If you're one of those Duke lacrosse players, and if you don't know what this is, look it up. But if you're one of those wrongly accused Duke lacrosse players. This thing got drug out so long and so wrongly in the media. These young men will never be meaningfully employed. Why? Because their reputation has been ruined by a lie. This is what Potiphar's wife sought to do to Joseph. Well, if I can't have him, if he's going to rebuff my advances, then I'm going to make it impossible for him to enjoy the position that he now enjoys. How evil. How insidious. What's really going on there? Well, I think she's just trying to preserve herself and keep her own position in the home. Because even among the Egyptians, infidelity like this would not be tolerated, especially if the woman was the instigator. That was unheard of, even in that debauched society. Let me just give you young people yet another hint. If you're ever in a situation where you're together and things happen that shouldn't happen, and it's based on mutual consent and mutual fault, own it. Both of you. We had an expression in my generation, it takes two to tango. Right? Don't run to the authorities with false accusations because you want to preserve your own reputation. Don't tell others that you're not at fault if you are. If you're at fault, either of you, own it. Own it. Don't do what Potiphar's wife did. Don't aggravate your sin by lying about it to save face. This is what she did. She was so afraid, I believe, that Joseph might go and report what had happened to her husband that she panicked and she concocted a story that would make Joseph the villain. And did it work? Yes. Yes. Verse 19. Now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, "This is what your slave did to me," his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. And that was it for Joseph. Right? God's plan for Joseph failed. God's chosen instrument was foiled by a woman. And he rotted in jail from that time on, right? No. Time for God to resort to plan B, right? No, good. Even while in prison, God continues to bless Joseph. Verse 21. But. Again, don't you just love that word? I mean, it all looks like curtains for Joseph. He's done. He'll rot in that jail. He's done the unthinkable. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. If there's ever been an example of the old adage, bloom where you're planted, this is it. What might Joseph have done? What would you do? You'd give up. Yeah, I mean, you would very quickly adopt the Eeyore syndrome. You'd be sitting in the jail. I would anyway. Woe is me. And I'll just eat a worm. Nobody loves me. Nobody cares. Most of us would throw a pity party of biblical proportions. He doesn't. I mean, it's almost like Joseph gets thrown into jail, and the moment he lands in jail, he's like, okay, what can I do? That's the kind of man he was. We're going to talk about, in the next hour, we're going to talk about counting it all joy. Joseph knew how to count it all joy. Well, I'm here. Lord, what now? What is my next adventure? He didn't complain. He didn't get down on himself. The Lord prospered him. Joseph understood this. We would do well to understand it as well. In happy times and not so happy times. In sunshine and rain. Whether we're up, whether we're down. We can and should have the settled assurance that Joseph had. That God is at work in us to bring about whatever is necessary for our good and His glory. You know, by the time you get to the account of Joseph being reunited with his brothers, you know, we tend to think, oh, it was that time when the light bulb went off and Joseph had this epiphany and Joseph said, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. I don't think that's true at all. I think Joseph understood this the moment he was sold. It's what faith does. Faith enables us to believe the unbelievable. Faith enables us to lean completely on God's understanding and not our own. Faith enables us to understand that no matter where we find ourselves, God is still at work, bringing about His good pleasure. We need to understand that when we find ourselves in situations like Joseph found himself in. We need to reflect on these examples. Last week I read from Isaiah 61. Remember that passage where we read that God gives beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness? Why? That we may be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that He may be glorified. You see, God's not glorified when we sit in that jail cell and cry buckets of crocodile tears. God's not glorified when we complain about our circumstances. Why? Because if He is in control of every circumstance, who are you actually complaining against? Be careful when you complain against circumstances. Because what you're actually complaining against is God Himself. You're complaining against His providence. You're complaining against His wisdom. You're complaining against His foreknowledge. We need to understand and appreciate that wherever we are, whatever we're experiencing, as His children, we're always right at the center of His will. I am sick to death of hearing believers say, I just don't understand what God's will for my life is. You're living it. I'm trying to find God's will for my life. It's like looking into a mirror and saying, I'm trying to find my face. You're living God's will wherever you're at any given time. You're right in the center of the will of a thrice holy, immutable, and sovereign God who loves you, who cares for you, and will prosper you according to His definition of prosperity. Remember, prosperity is not always monetary. Prosperity can also be health. It can also be a settled contentment, a joy, regardless of our circumstances. Prosperity comes in many forms. And God has promised you, and He will make good on this promise, He will prosper you in due time. Besides all that, folks, if you're a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, this temporal realm, this period of time, you know, most of us, by God's grace, will get 80, 85 years by recent actuarial standards. Okay, that's well and good, but do you realize even 100 years is not even a blip on the radar in the span of eternity? You have eternity to prosper. With Him, how much more prosperous does it get? Right? We're joint heirs with Jesus Christ. Who cares if God has put your prosperity plan on layaway? You'll get it when you die, okay? You'll get it when He returns. But it's yours nonetheless. Understand that. Think about what Joseph's been through up to this point. He's gone from being his father's favorite to hated brother, to a slave, promoted to a really prominent position, and then demoted for being a despised criminal who by all rights could only hope at this point to receive a merciful execution. That's what should have happened to him. He should have been put to death. But God. But have you ever noticed what Joseph never does? Have we heard a whimper out of Joseph? No. Have we heard a single complaint out of Joseph? Nope. Joseph is eerily silent in the face of all of this. Why? How? Because he knew his God. And he knew whatever his God ordained was right. Joseph appears to have resigned himself completely to God as a part of God's sovereign plan. And how would God's plan continue in Joseph's life? I mean, what could possibly undo or adequately address Joseph's seemingly insurmountable problem here? Well, it'll all begin with Joseph's coming to the aid of Pharaoh's butler and baker. Right? And in a turn of providence that only the Lord Himself could bring about, the same gift. Now imagine this. The same gift that had gotten Joseph in so much trouble with his brothers in the first place would lead to unimaginable blessing. That's how God works. Some would say that Joseph's gift was a curse, that he knew too much, that he used his ability to interpret dreams for his benefit only. It's not true. It's not true, and we'll see that more and more in the next lesson.